to another episode. Today we are recording episode 110, and I can't believe I'm saying 110. Just realized that it seems like yesterday I started doing this. And here you go. We record these episodes on a weekly basis, and we talk to various influencers and decision makers and experts in a variety of topics in our language industry or in a technology industry. And today I have the honor and the pleasure to be joined by Veronica Hilek. Veronica, thank you so much for joining me. You don't need a lot of introduction, but I'll let you introduce yourself in a second. Thank you so much for taking the time and being with me on the call. I've been looking for this conversation for a while now, since we started talking about doing this episode together. So you're welcome. And nice to meet you, by the way. The first time I'm meeting you online, so that's pretty cool.
I know. Nice to meet you, too. It's been in the plan for about 2 months now. I'm finally getting to talk to you, which is awesome.
Thanks so much. And just for the audience, if you don't mind, we say on this channel, everybody's got a story, right? So, and some of them are interesting. And, you know, the categories of these stories, they fall into one or two. One is I walked into the translation industry or the localization industry, language industry by accident. Or somebody tells me it's a happy coincidence. Or somebody says, you know, accidentally on purpose. So where do you fit? Tell us your story.
I'm all three. I will say, so my mother owns a small boutique LSP. I have seen her run that since I was a baby. I can tell you firsthand, I still remember like the hard paper kind of deadlines on like the old Macs, and Thursday night, every single night she would have these language deadlines for a particular client. So I've seen it for the last 30 years, but really got active in the industry probably about 4 or 5 years ago. Falling into it. I was on the government side. I was more corporate, Sony, before that, Walmart. And my mother's company needed a piece of software. And me and my co-founder built it in our free time, just on our nights while we were working for the government. And long story short, a lot of people needed it. So it wound up launching as a free beta for a while at ATA a few years ago. And then we wound up having a partnership with Trados, and everything just kind of continued to unfold there, and eventually evolved into a translation plus interpreting management platform. So,
so you come from the tech side, right, Veronica? You come from the tech side,
yeah. Tech side, yeah, 100%, yeah.
And what's your background from a tech perspective?
I'm more on the product management side. I really funny pivot 180. I studied actually concert piano and communications in college. Very, very, very different.
Wow.
I was on a scholarship. then my goal was to become a music copyright attorney. So I wound up working for Sony Music, got right into SQL database stuff, like pretty much right off
the bat. Oh my God. Yeah. You're speaking my language now.
No, it was like the music industry is like they have billions and billions of unpaid royalties and, you know, hundreds of thousands or millions of lines. So basically started that right away and then pivoted into product management, into the government side, where I started doing AI and ML for AI drone ships, which is like completely different, you know, from that. And we were using like, it's funny, we never called it AI at the time. Like we called it decision-making software. Very, very, you know, very advanced.
But we were keep it under wrap. Keep it under wrap.
Yeah, decision-making software. But it was the same. It was the same decision-making software. I'll still say it to this day. That was used on like the Mars rover and everything like that. And then you know had a startup and landed back into AI. A crazy kind of side. But I'm the person that figures out how to build something, what to build, and I'm really good at kind of communicating the technical terms in between the people that have no idea what tech means and the super technical people. So that's kind of where I fall.
Well, you're the bridge between the wizards and the users.
Pretty much.
Which is very interesting because, I feel like there's always a gap between the, you know, how complex the technology can be at some point for those who don't not familiar with it or they haven't used it before. They're not intimate with it. And the users who are going to be using it and try to distill that information into some usable format for those individuals. That's where the product comes along and says, okay, so somebody got to use this high-end technology. How do we make them use it?
Well, do we make it use it? That's pretty much the question. It's actually a really hard job to do because ultimately the product person needs to become a SME in a particular topic, they need to like really understand that end user. They have to figure out what's going to be sticky. And if we're going to like tie it into localization, you know, I'm seeing like a really big blend that localization is like not a siloed industry or workflow anymore. It's like becoming a product problem to get more users, to get more sales, to get more conversions. You know, companies are thinking about language access globally through that lens of that user trust, like not translation coverage. And so it's becoming like even more increasingly like a product problem, believe it or not, translation and localization. From that,
we moved away from, you know, being an afterthought. Now it's becoming more mainstream business, if you will.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I come from the startup world, the corporate side. When a product really wants to gain any sort of credibility or traction, what's like the first thing they start to think about is expanding to a new market. How are you going to do that? You know, localization. So it's pretty much how most people start to pivot into a, I want to say like a level of maturity in their platform, but to get user trust and get more users pretty much.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, when we were chatting back and forth about the topic that we're going to address today, which is pretty timely, I guess, I distilled all that back and forth together and I just sort of maybe frame it in a way for our audience. Today's conversation, hopefully we will address, you know, the elephant in the room in the industry, I would call it, where we talk about translation as a feature and why Silicon Valley thinks the problem is solved, which I agree with you. And it's very dangerous to say it is solved, but hence it is not solved. And that's why we're going to demonstrate through our conversations today that this is a dangerous threat to be on, a track to be on, to think I download an app, I put it into my software and, you know, Bob's your uncle. It's done. It's finished. Let's move on from there. And I agree with the topic because a lot of times I hear people saying, you know, I mean, I got the conversation a few weeks ago. Somebody said to me, we solved the language problem. Now what? So it's just, I get that all the time.
I get it too. It's crazy. Like these SF people, like, and my, you know, my brother actually owns like a YC backed startup. Like I'm like very much in that world. They think translation is a solved problem. And there's LLMs were made for translation purposes. Like we have to understand that to a degree, like there is a level of efficiency that is coming, but why do they think it's a solved problem? I have that question for you. I have a suspicion why I think it's a solved problem, but why do you think it's a solved problem?
Well, for me, I mean, it comes down to two things, speed and cost. And, you know, people are afraid of the, and you know, let's do self-criticism a little bit on our industry a little bit. I always like to reflect back on my 25 years in this business. You know, when I first started doing this job, I was taken to a room and I said, I come from the tech background. I mean, I'm a computer science grad. I did not really do translation at all. I didn't know translation existed. All my life, I thought translation is an IP address translation. It is not language translation. I speak three languages. I never thought I need somebody to be the medium between taking the content from one language, putting it to another language. My first day on the job in this business, I was told, you know, I said, so this is the training. They're training me to be a business development person in this industry. I was taken to a room. I said, so what's the training here? I said, we take a content from one word, put it into another word. It was simpler time, I guess. Now it's not as simple as that. But I tell you, during those simple times and during I would call it the 100,000 foot pitch, if you will, we were able to grow the company at a multiple X's per year versus today. You know, in order for the industry to remedy, I would call it, and again, self-criticism, part of the industry, right? So I'm allowed to do this. To remedy the psychological issues that we probably have as an industry, we need somebody always, the insecurities, for instance, somebody patting us on the back saying, yeah, you did a good job. You're taking on like large projects and you're getting it done well. We perfected the art of complexity in our industry. So there are many from outside the industry looking in say, wow, that's complex. How do I do this? There was an article on Slater, I want to say about 6 months, a year ago, about Mr. Beast, a YouTube reality guy, personality, who says, I'm done with the localization industry. I'm going to open my own AI company. And when you ask what happened there, based on the article, I don't know the guy. I have no idea who he is. But based on the article, it says, too complex, too slow.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine. He's a Forbes contributor. I think he's text our mentor, I don't know. And he texted me about 2 months ago, and he was like, the pricing model of the localization industry is the worst that I've ever seen. Like, that was what he told me. And he was launching like a healthcare startup of some sort, healthcare marketplace. And it was the funniest text I've ever received, because he's more in healthcare, medical kind of stuff. And like, he clearly spent several hours trying to understand how to localize his app. You know, and it was extremely complex. He thought it was broken the way that it was being priced, and just too complicated. So yeah, I definitely hear that too.
So from your perspective, what do you think it is?
I think a lot of people don't know this industry exists. Like, that's my kind of gut feeling. There's no understanding or education of the nuance of this profession. So what happens? Well, they see Google Translate, they see ChatGPT translates, they go there, and that's kind of their first experience with translated content. And I just think we're invisible to many. So a lot assume we don't exist. So then what happens? I saw another startup come out of YC called, I think it's called Lingo Dev, that's promising to solve, kind of like a code first platform for localization, baking localization into the code. But there's no one in that startup that worked for our industry. They don't have a strong idea of how localization teams even function. We even discussed it with a few of our members in the AI localization think tank, and they were missing basic features like terminology management. So how can, you know, but still they were the ones that got the backing, they got the funding, the TechCrunch article, their NYC. It's like, there's, to a lot of people, a lot of these tech people, I just don't think they know we exist to a degree. Like, and it's kind of crazy to think about.
That's right.
We know, I look at content like severity risks, right? Like, you wouldn't use ChatGPT to help you do a surgery of somebody, like in a medical capacity, but there's not a basic understanding that, yeah, maybe we shouldn't use ChatGPT interpreter translate to navigate this very sensitive police situation. You know what I mean? Like, there's just that kind of understanding's not there, which is crazy.
And when do we do? What do we do? Like, what does Silicon Valley do when things don't go right? Like, what's the remedy there?
I don't know. I don't know what the remedy is. I do know every single time I have this conversation with, and you heard, we had the same sort of message that we hear, is that this is a solved problem. I talked to them for about 4 minutes. I'm like, look, you have one mistranslated word. You didn't get this cultural nuance right. You're going to lose clients. You're going to have, you know, you're going to have backlash. There's a lot of things. You're going to risk legal protection loss. And then they're asking me, okay, do you have, like, how do I find a language company, right? Like, it's just like a very basic level of understanding that they just don't have. So I don't want to say it's like education, but like, why are we not making it so clear that, like, yes, it does solve some content that can be auto-generated that has very low risk, like Instagram captions, but it's not solving a lot of issues that puts your company at risk and risks revenue. You know, that understanding's not there.
That's right. And the amount of content being created, I'm assuming, and that's what Silicon Valley has been trying to do, is that amount of content being created is overwhelmingly creating a delta between the human capacity of producing the content, or translating the content in this case, versus what the content is being created, like the voluminous amount of it is being created for, and the speed to market and all these factors, which, you know, requires people to look for alternatives. And back, you know, you mentioned it earlier, like, you know, categorizing your content, high stake, low stake, medium stake, and then you apply what's needed there. But the notion, back to the notion that the problem is solved, it's far from being solved. There's, you know, the internet is flooded with instances where Instagram, for instance, using an auto-generated translation, you know, called some president in some Asian country, very bad name, and put everybody at an embarrassing situation. So there is a lot of those things happening.
Yeah, and I think I go back to my stance that localization is a product problem. And I came across a stat from a blog post on User Pilot, I think. It was such an interesting article because it was written by a product manager. It wasn't written by, you know, a linguist or a LSP or anything. Excuse me. And it said, something like 52% of users have uninstalled apps due to poor localization. 52%. And it was just crazy because there was this quote that I loved. It was written in this article, something like, mobile app localization is not throwing your copy into Google Translate and calling it a day. Like, I think that was, it was something along those lines. And this product manager became so passionate about making sure that every single word of their mobile interface was, you know, understood and localized correctly, because it was impacting their conversions and it was impacting their sales. So yeah, I think it's the, I don't want to say it again, the education.
That's right. And you know, the industry itself, like, if I mean, stepping back a little bit, the industry itself, we're not a marketing industry, right? So like the automotive industry spends billions of dollars on marketing, right? The healthcare industry spends maybe trillions of dollars on it, on marketing, telling the message, sending the story out. Our industry is shy. You know, we don't, you know, if you talk to the NIMSY of the world, or you talk to any of our research companies out there, you know, yeah, we're not good at marketing ourselves as an industry, right? So it's, I mean, that's not a secret. So we don't tell the story well, I think, as an industry. We need more of it. We need to tell it better. And we need to educate the public a little bit better to stop being an afterthought. I mean, even today, when somebody's building something, a software or a product of any sort, you know, they build it in English. And then, you know, 3/4 through the way of the product development cycle, somebody comes into the development team and says, hey, by the way, we got to put this in 20 languages. And they got to go back to ground zero, try to figure out the architecture.
Yeah. No, it's definitely, definitely crazy. I mean, I don't know that I hate sales. I hate marketing. People think I'm very outgoing and stuff. It's really funny. I'm really quiet, actually. I get nervous.
Well, you don't come across that.
I know. Backstage, I was so nervous. I hope I don't, like, you know, say something wrong and get something thrown at me. But you know, you have to be, especially, like, I mean, you know, translation volume is going up or down depending on who you ask, of course,
right.
Looking at different metrics. But you know, in order to survive, like, this next wave, like, you're going to educate your end client. You're going to have to tell them why you're indispensable, and that is completely normal and fine. You know, every industry is dealing with that pressure right now. I saw a quote from the Shopify CEO that said, no more new hires until you can prove that this job can't be done by AI. Like, this is just, you know, nothing to do with translation. I think people are taking it personally. It's not personal. Everyone's being impacted. So we have to get better at just communicating.
And that's the same CEO who terminated all the localization teams.
Did they? Oh, really?
Yep. I mean, not all of them, probably 90% of them, maybe like they kept maybe one or two internally, but yeah.
So funny. Boostlingo. Did you see Duolingo. Their CEO had a huge backlash a few weeks ago by basically kind of insinuating that they were going to try to go all AI with their employees, and everybody started freaking out, and he came back and retracted, and he was like, oh, that was not my intention. Like, we won't use AI to replace people. And all I could think about in my head was, well, you did, like, a year ago with your linguists. Like, I remember the article from a year ago. Like, Duolingo was a language app and he got rid of them. So I'm like, okay, this is like such BS, excuse my French, but it was just so funny because there, like, people were talking about, oh, he's retracting. I'm like, well, he's also lying because he already did that. So yeah, it's
I love this conversation. You know what? Nobody came to this channel to have this level of openness with this conversation. I'm enjoying it 100%. You are going to be a regular guest on this channel. Hey, by the way, you're a podcaster yourself too, by the way. I hear you have Hey AI, aren't you?
I do. I started it. It's so funny. I was in AI. I felt like every week I had outdated information, because it's like you see like 40 new feature updates and you're like, oh my god, like, what's important? So then you don't look at any of it. So I selfishly started it as a project for myself, just to distill it into the top 5 important updates for the week. I originally started as a written blog. My partner was like, nobody's gonna read that, Veronica, you know, go on YouTube, because, like, at least I can listen to it as I'm walking. And it took off. Like, I had quite a few videos on LinkedIn that hit like 6-7 million views. And I just really enjoy it because it forces me. I'm not like a software developer by trade, even if I like had to be very technical in my roles. So it forces me to like look at, like, for example, a research paper of a new Google architecture called Titans, like how they're doing memory recall, distill it and understand it for myself, and then like take another level of understanding and explain it to everybody else. I really like doing it. It takes a lot of time. But yeah, it's been a really fun project for me.
Now, going back to the Silicon Valley issue, what are we going to do with those tech guys that they think the problem is solved?
Well, we could let them bite themselves in the butt and you know, have a huge cultural blip that affects their, you know, sales. No, I'm just joking. I keep saying that word educate, but that is what marketing is. That's what sales is. We got to be doing a better job of marketing our value. And to me, we talked about those kind of content tiers, like even the human translator, for example, they feel threatened by AI. I know a lot of people, like I'm very much in the middle between the ATA traditional linguist side, like the enterprise side, and understanding like how the tech's being built, like a level of automation is to be expected. To me, like it's very clear where these human linguists are going to sit on like what type of content, like where you're going to need cultural nuance, where it's going to be high stake environment, where you want to make sure that you're not going to, you know, lose legal protection on a patent, for example. And clients need to understand that to a degree that, you know, it seems like even in our own industry, we're struggling to understand that. So make expectations very clear.
Do you think our industry should push back?
Push back on what?
On the idea that the problem is solved and can test it?
100%. I mean, this is.
And how do you think we should do that?
I don't know. I mean, I have conversations with these people, and it becomes clear after 4 or 5 minutes. But how do we do that on an industry wide level? I mean, I guess you could start with case studies. But I don't know how to make that message so clear. I don't know. I think, like, for example, I'm just showing you like a marketing example. Interpreters and translators seem very out of reach for people, for a lot of individuals. And I saw Boostlingo recently started to call their mobile app or something Uber for interpreters or something like that. And it was very subtle, right? Like Uber for interpreters, but it was very understandable that, okay, when I need an interpreter, I go to the app and I get it like that, right? So how do we kind of communicate that level of complexity onto the content level side? I don't know. I guess that's a topic for every corporation to go through.
I know, but I mean, on the product side, right, product development side, there must be a mindset in the tech companies where they get to the products itself,
yeah,
and they come into that localization question mark or roundabout, you know, traffic roundabout. And like in Canada, we get confused at roundabout. We don't know how to handle them. It's not built for Canada, I guess. Yeah. And they get to the localization discussion in the product development lifecycle. I say, okay, this is confusing. I like to simplify it. And it comes back to simplification. Like, are we not, as an industry, simplifying enough for these products or making it convenient enough for those product developers to think, okay, API versus simple process, which one do I want? This one is guaranteed. This one is not guaranteed.
Well, so let's start with, you know, one, make ourselves super accessible, because they really don't know that that's an option, I find, most of the time. Like, they don't. But from, like, a product perspective, do you want more money? Do you want more users? Do you want your product to be sticky? Do you want, you know, your user to feel heard and understood, like not just like seen, you know, empty words that you kind of understand what's saying? You know, do you want that, or do you want like your experience to be, you know, junk? Like, because I go back to that blog post and that stat, 52% of them uninstalling because it's poorly localized. That's over 50%. That's huge.
That's, you know, huge. So, you're right.
Yeah. So your app's not gonna, it's not gonna be able to grow, I guess, is really.
And nobody develop any software nowadays just for the English speaking world or whatever local country you're in, French, whatever, Italian. Most people want to develop these apps to be used globally, worldwide. Right. And in order for you to do that, then that means the local audience whatever they happen to be, they need to understand what you're trying to do. Back in the days, 20 years ago, there was a saying, specifically in North America, in the US, if you don't speak English, you don't buy our products. And they were proud of that. Some companies, and I won't name any companies, they were proud of that. You don't deserve to buy our product if you don't speak English. Globalization happened, and now products are going between borders, countries, etc., freely. And now the competition is not, it's locally as much as it's globally, and they're all intertwined. So therefore, you have to put your product in that available to your global audience in their language, by the way.
I mean, even with, the app that I co-founded, that became a question pretty early on. We had users, I think, in 18 or 19 different countries at one point. And that was the question. Like, we were getting requests in Arabic, we were getting requests in German. And we were US based, right? Like, this was not something that originally thought about. But we couldn't tap into those markets until we did that. And I mean, I don't know if it's because it was an app for the language industry, it never even came across my mind to ever use MT. But people, the users of that platform, of our platform, really cared about it so much that we got feature requests to be able to white label it themselves. Like, they like, for their companies, they wanted to ensure that the translation was so perfect that they wanted, and it was just ridiculous to provide that as a feature. We didn't.
That's right.
But still, it just shows how important it was for their users to feel like it was very well localized in order to retain the client.
One of the things that we keep talking about on the tech side in our industry is the phase that we're in right now. Nobody can disagree that technology is changing, and this technology that we're living in is different than the rest of the ages that I've seen. This one is evolving rapidly. It's learning its own. It doesn't wait for a developer to do something, some tweaks. Of course, the developer is still involved, but in general, technology itself, it's evolving, it's learning. Like, I'm talking about artificial intelligence. So there was I know. I should probably give it away, did I? I should have labeled it. that was part of the joke. I know. What is that? Yeah, of course. So one of the things that we're talking about here in where we are right now, in the stage we are in, is the phase of trust. Can you assess that for us? Where do you think we are right now in terms of how much are we trusting the technology? And maybe vice versa. Maybe is the technology assessing how much they can trust us? Are we?
I'll start with that answer with experience I had with ChatGPT actually yesterday. I experienced a data bleed where I uploaded a screenshot asking it to explain this first notification to me from my phone. And it was something like, your fridge was opened and needs to change the water filter. Like, that was the notification. But instead, it responded, this notification shows that you paid a $50 Cash App transaction to John Ellis or something like this. And it started to list out all of, personal names, financial information. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, I don't know what John Ellis, like,
who is that?
I don't have Cash App. Like, this is like crazy. Like, where are you getting this from? And ChatGPT was like, sorry, my bad. This is actually what your notification means. And then it proceeds to read me something about Apple Wallet, adding this one card. So I'm like, this is nothing at all. So, answer your question very bluntly. I study AI. I've been in AI, those decision-making software systems, for a good amount of time. I also apply it very sparingly within my own life because I think most of them are toys. I hate the word AI agent. I know that's like the new like buzzword. I really hate it because I see these LinkedIn posts or even just, use cases. And they're like, I just got rid of 15 people with this AI agent architecture, blah, 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 blah. And I'm just looking at it, I'm like, that's going to run one scenario. No way. Like, I'm like, it's not built for reliability. A lot of them. I am not saying that that's not true 100%. Like, it absolutely, especially in our industry, they're building a lot of these systems for precision. That's all they're working on. They're being very cognizant about that. And absolutely, they're getting, performance results. But for the majority of these AI tools that I'm seeing, they're toys at best. And I'll give one more example. I turned down a CPO position that I was interviewing for a couple months ago for a Series A fintech company here in the UK. And in the final round, I was talking to their chief AI scientist, and she asked me point blank in, this interview, being backed by two of the largest banks in the UK, we're building this model, but we don't know what to use it for. What would you use it for?
And I'm so why are you building the model?
I'm like, first of all, how can I possibly answer that without knowing what you illuminated, what data you're training on, like all these things? But they had funding, and they clearly were getting pressured by these big companies to come up with something that wasn't a toy anymore. And they don't even know what use case they're working towards. And I think that's the majority of, like, 90% of these AI apps are like, let's throw something at the wall and see if something sticks. And some of them will stick, like Robin, like, please don't get me wrong, but like, most of them are junk, in my opinion.
That's very honest. I love that. I have a sense that this is happening, because if you look at most publicly traded company, and that's public information, you can check it out, that the stock price of those publicly traded companies is directly connected to their cost and efficiency in their organizations. And they're using AI to hedge against their costs. So these applications are directly trying to drive the cost down, but, it goes to the middle management or somebody in high level even, and they say, okay, we deploy AI, and everybody's saying, well, what do you want me to do? Back to the throw mud on the wall and see what sticks. Let me come up with 20 ideas and see if one of them would stick.
It is. Well, that comes from, like, again, it's funny from an education perspective, right? Like, a lot of these decision makers at the top don't understand what AI can and can't do. So let's start there. I remember when ChatGPT, like, really first hit, I consulted a lot on building software systems, especially. Had this, what's it called, video surveillance company contact me through a conference I spoke at, and they wanted me to implement AI, blah, blah, blah. And I met with them, and they're like, we want to implement ChatGPT to help us determine the report types when something happens. Like, in a parking lot, somebody steals a car, or there's a pet accident or something. And I'm looking at them, I'm like, you're going to implement ChatGPT to do something that would, you could fix with adding one single field saying incident type? They just want to implement AI everywhere, and they don't really know, like, LLMs are not really, like, there's a lot of ways they could do object detection or anything that they didn't even have, like, vision implemented, but they wanted to use ChatGPT to auto figure out the incident type on these reports. And it was just like a lack of education. Again, like, they don't understand what type of AI to use for what situation.
So speaking of that, and since you are an expert on this, I got to ask you, so what makes it a good AI application? What are the main characteristics for that, in your opinion?
Really, I can give you a very clean answer on this. It's reliable. That output's reliable 85% of the time. It's getting very consistent results. It is protecting your data. That is really the only goal that I can see very, clearly. If you're not getting reliable output that you want, then it's it's junk, as I keep saying.
But that's right. That's right. And I heard a lot of conversations between, specifically to our industry, that goes back and forth between the data scientists and the linguists. Have you ever had that conversation? Like, who, from a training the AI perspective, the data scientist says, give me the files, I'll train it. The linguist says, hang on a second now, I'm not sure if these files are correct, and the output validation is going to take you forever.
I have not personally been part of those conversations. You have to talk to, like, Marina Pancheva on that. She would love to talk to you about that.
What's your opinion on the matter?
What I can tell you is what's the classic phrase they say, garbage in, garbage out, right? So, if a lot of the assets, the translation memories, the term bases, like everything that people are using are not cleaned, they're really messy. There are no really good tools to automate that process, but, like, cleaning your data is, like, step one to improve. Yeah, and that's, I mean, I guess the linguists, clearly are showing that, but the data scientists are not understanding that the data is not cleaned, right? Which is crazy to think about.
right. Like, and you know, there is this notion of good enough, right? So, and I don't know when good enough it becomes dangerous. Sometimes good enough is good enough. I don't know, but there is a threshold I think people are passing where good enough is not applied anymore because now it's becoming into dangerous territory.
Yeah. Well, let's think about it from, again, education, 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 keep saying it. The majority of people on this planet, their first interaction with translation is how? Through social media. It's through Facebook. It's through Instagram, through TikTok. It's through YouTube. And a lot of those use API plugins like Google Translate. That accuracy is like 82% at best, you know, average, you know, some 55 or less. And I feel like partially some users have accepted that that's the standard. Which isn't good. Like, I'm not talking about like apps that you're trying to sell, but like they've kind of accepted that when they see an Instagram post in English and it's translated to Arabic, for example, that it's going to be good enough, and that's just, you know, okay. And is it? I don't know. Instagram caption, does it need to go through a human linguist verification? It never would. But I think also there's, I remember Trottos came out with this phrase a couple years ago, a year and a half ago, called translate everything. And at the time I thought it was like really kind of stupid, to be honest. But then I was like, actually what they're saying, which is totally true, is we are having the ability to touch so much more content than never would have been translated before. So to a level, you know, there's a additional accessibility that a lot of people wouldn't have even had remote access to this kind of information. So I don't really know that answer, but I do know that, you know, it's not something that can just completely be like that tier two, tier three I always talk about is like that. We can't even begin to touch that safely, I think.
Yeah. And you know, like every time the technology evolves, it proves that we still have some growing to do as a human. So, you know, not just necessarily applicability of how technology is being used in taking, you know, content from one language, put it into another language, you know, to somewhat accurately, accuracy and quality is in the eyes of the beholder. I guess the reader and the consumer of that content can make that decision. Some of them are more vocal than the others, and I can give a few examples on this one. The idea here is that, look, we're going to continue evolving, but we're going to transfer to the technology what we know as humans. So to a large extent, it starts to replicate us. It starts to understand it a little better. And this is where ethics comes in. This is where, you know, equality comes in, and who's monitoring all this and who's keeping the check on that, right? So when we take a dry topic like legal or scientific topics and we put them in one language and put them in AI and produce them in another language, that's one thing. But when you inject the whole ethical way of translating and making sure, like I with the team in Riyadh November, and I did a workshop on a human in the middle for young graduates from University of King Khalid in Riyadh, and there was like a few hundred people in the room, and the workshop was around human in the middle when it comes to AI output. So you get AI output or machine translation output. But at the same time, you keep the human engaged in that, vetting it, looking at it, trying to see it. And all these young students were coming out of university thinking that, and that's why they attended the workshop, do I still have a job by the end of my graduation? Or AI is going to take my job, right? So I take a drug repercussion. So if you take the drug, what happened, and how to take the drug, instruction, how to take the drug. Very simple, like instruction to the patient. I generate it in English and I generate in Arabic. I speak Arabic. So I put it up on the wall, and that was my first slide. And I spent the hour discussing a 3-4 sentences in Arabic. I got hands coming up saying, this is wrong. And to me, I'm reading it. It looks good. But to the people who are immersed in their cultures, who are immersed in their language, there is 100 ways that this is wrong. But for me, who was distant from the language, you know, I mean, I have not been in the Middle East for about 40 years, not close to it. They are. And they found it, oh my God, they were chunking it, piecing it together. it goes to show to some people like me who are, you know, superficial consumer of the Arabic language. Okay, so that was understood. That's fine. For them who are embedded in the language, hell no, it's not acceptable.
And I guess goes back to the question you were kind of just asking, who is responsible for that? Like, what if somebody took that, medical disclaimer in Arabic and it was not, didn't, you know, tell them that they could die potentially if they had a heart condition, for example, properly. I have an answer who I think is responsible. Who do you think is responsible?
I personally, everybody who touched that content is responsible ultimately.
I think ultimately, yes, to a degree. I think it's ultimately the final deliverer, like who put that final stamp, you know, in that case, it would be the medical company. Because they decided at that point, and this is, goes back to like, you would never do this, right? Because this is a significant amount of lawsuits and everything else. Like, why would you take that risk? They, at the end of the day, made that decision that good enough was good enough, and it wasn't.
Yes, right.
So, you know.
And it's very funny, like, to me to be talking about this, to be honest with you. Here's why. Because if you ask any tech company, any company in the world, it doesn't matter what sector they're in, ask them the question, how much does the localization cost you in total of spend? Like, what percentage of localization is your total spend? I can bet you, and I can venture to guess, but I'm betting because I've talked to a few of them, that it would be below not even 2% of their total spend. They buy more pencils versus how much they pay for localization. And meanwhile, we're having so much conversation about localization. It's not even...
It's true. It's the software to implement. I mean, the software is where the real money comes, and, you know, of course. But it is true, like, to actually localize it at the end of the day, you know, is minimal compared to that. And then again, how much risk you're avoiding, how many potential customers you may gain. I kind of look at it similarly to UX UI improvements. A lot of times I love, this is going back to me being like a product nerd, but like, there's this Apple human interface guidelines, the HIG or something like that, around those. But basically, from 1984, I found this book in a random pile of junk outside somewhere that somebody was throwing out. And it basically said that humans need to feel in control of the interface, not the other way around. And a lot of research has supported that like when you're like a design first, your return on investment is 30, 40, 50%. But the last 20 years, software development's really focused on functionality. Like, they don't really care about the end user. A lot of times it's just, can they do this function or not? And now people are starting to realize that's not good enough anymore. Like, you can't have these 15-year-old clunky systems. It needs to feel really light. And I feel like localization is like really the same deal. Like, you're investing a little bit up front for a big ROI.
I'm enjoying this conversation. I thought I can talk to you for hours. literally, I love this. I mean, I don't know how many people know, but I write my own software for my own use. I do. I code Python. I do integration with OpenAI and do all that stuff. I just play with it on the weekend. But I enjoy it. And this conversation is just like nostalgia for me, but that's okay.
What's your favorite thing that you've built recently? Or I guess like, what's the favorite thing? What is like, okay, it doesn't have to be something that you've built, but like, what is something that you've like wanted to build, I guess, recently? Or like, what's been your favorite?
So I built one recently and I'm thinking about productizing it. It's okay. It's a social media platform, and where it communicates with X at this point, but I can make it communicate with other profiles. So on X right now, so it's connected to OpenAI, and it mimics a human behavior completely. It produces jokes, it produces facts, it goes to news websites of any topic I wanted to, distill the news, formulates it into 145 characters, and sends it out. And it cycles through. I give it like 7 different behaviors, it depends on the day. And it takes in consideration like the 500 posts per month and reverse engineer the number of posts that you can put out per day.
That's amazing.
It sends it, it randomizes the sense, so it doesn't, the other systems on the other, my background is telecom too, so the servers on the other side doesn't detect a single pattern. There's no single pattern.
Really thought this through, man.
Yeah.
It's funny, I think we won't be working on different things, but I'm sunsetting my current startup just because it's a long story, but just not really fell into it. It's not really what I want to be doing anymore. But I've recently toiled with the fact of coming up with a social media killer, like how to destroy social media. I'm calling it Alt F4, you know, basically Windows. I've been working on that for a few months just for fun, because I actually really hate social media. I need to like turn off my phone for days on end. And it's funny. So we might be competitors if I decide to go.
The great idea. I really like that. Social media sometimes is too much cloudy, I guess.
I think it's stealing our lives. That's a conversation for another day, of course. But yeah.
We'd like to do a podcast on that one.
Absolutely.
My last question for you, if you don't mind, if you had a magic wand to wave, and you're exposed to every technology, you know about, you're elbow deep in AI and the rest of the other technology, as a product leader, and you want the people to understand one thing about the current technology right now, what would you tell them to understand? What would you tell them to resonate after this conversation?
AI?
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest thing would be the impact to human thought that people are not really realizing is a risk. We are starting to default critically thinking ourselves through problems to an AI chatbot, a machine that's always on. And I don't think we fully understand the impact of that yet. So to be cautious is my magic wand that I would say, because I see posts of parents saying to my 8-year-old, it's going to be using ChatGPT, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, this is not good, right? Because they're running it through with math problems, 2 + 2 = 4. They're not thinking about it. But say ChatGPT says 5, they're not questioning it. Like there's just, I think there's a really strong risk to human thought, originality, and just problem solving. So yeah.
Yeah, embrace it, but embrace it cautiously. That's what you're saying. Just know what you're trying to commit to, basically, when you select these technologies.
Yeah.
No, I really appreciate it, Veronica. It's an awesome to have you with me today. I really appreciate it. What do you think of the conversation?
That's so much fun. I really like it. I just, for everyone else's context, like Robin gave me no blueprint. Like I had no idea what I'm walking into here.
That's right.
I really enjoy it. And I think these kinds of conversations, the most natural thought comes. I know this is the first time I really met you. I tend to be relatively unfiltered, for better or for worse. So hopefully
that's the best way to have it.
No, but
unfiltered, unbiased, unscripted.
I think it's my Slavic side. It's just like there's no time for BS. You know, you cut it through.
And right, cut through the noise.
Yeah, that's again. That's why I started the blog. So, it was wonderful to meet you, Rob, and thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful to meet you as well, Veronica. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. And for our audience, thank you for listening in for our podcast. Thank you for listening in for the episode 110. And again, I just want to remind everybody that's a personal initiative that I started a few years ago. It is not supported by anybody. Our tagline is unfiltered, unscripted, unbiased. And we're not supported by anybody. So all we ask in return is like, share, and distribute the comment to your the content to your network. I really appreciate your support. Thanks again, and I will see you on the other side. And Veronica, don't hang up. Stick around for a second.
Ciao, ciao.